From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleinman, and you're listening to Good Food. Being a farmer today is no walk in the park. American farmers face many challenges, including climate change, falling profits, and an aging pool of labor, just to name a few. And so this week, we're revisiting our show on the American way of farming. It first aired in January. We begin with the Farm Bill. If you don't know what's in this huge, unwieldy piece of legislation, you're hardly alone. Here to give us a 101 on the Farm Bill is Leah Douglas. She's a reporter covering food and agriculture for the Open Markets Institute. Hi, Leah.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
For many people, the Farm Bill might seem like a completely arcane piece of legislation that has no connection to them, and yet you've spent a lot of time writing and thinking about it. Why is that?
Well, I think the Farm Bill is actually a really relevant piece of legislation for pretty much anyone who cares about agriculture, the environment, health policy, and who really consumes any food that's produced in the U.S. Among other things, the Farm Bill funds major nutrition programs in the U.S., so anyone with a child who's in a school lunch program, who receives supplementary nutrition assistance program funding, WIC funding, those are all folks who are directly affected by the Farm Bill debates that we're seeing already underway in Congress.
So that covers a lot. Give us an outline of what is in the Farm Bill.
Sure. So the vast majority of funding in the Farm Bill, about 80% goes to nutrition programs. So the programs I just mentioned, including school lunch, school breakfast programs, SNAP funding, WIC, and other programs. About 14% of the remaining funding goes to crop subsidies and insurance programs for farmers. Another 6% goes towards conservation funding, and a relatively marginal amount, 0.2% or something like that, goes to research programs that research funding for agriculture.
How does the Farm Bill get put together?
Well, every 5 years, Congress is tasked with renewing the Farm Bill, and that timeline gets warped sometimes from cycle to cycle, given how many political roadblocks pop up, but it's supposed to happen every 5 years. And the ag committees, agriculture committees in the House and Senate bear a lot of the responsibility of holding hearings and soliciting feedback from major stakeholders that are affected by the Farm Bill and seeing, you know, what should be improved from last time and what should be added or subtracted from the bill, which the funding for the Farm Bill nears about $1 trillion each cycle. So it's an enormous amount of funding that is decided in those every five-year debates.
Why was it originally created?
Well, the Farm Bill was originally conceptualized in 1933 as a way to boost prices for farmers during the Depression era. And it was actually, subsidies were first imagined as a way to pay farmers to not grow some major commodity crops that were sort of the backbone of American agricultural production. The idea being if farmers weren't growing those things, that the prices would go up and the markets would stabilize. So that was the original conception in the 30s. And over time, nutrition programs were added and the scope of the bill really moved beyond that initial purpose.
It sort of started to become this sort of rural-urban balanced bill.
Yeah, absolutely. And we can see increasingly in the debates around the bill today, there are stakeholders are far beyond just food and farm groups in the way we would think of them. You know, typically when an average person would hear about the Farm Bill, the only connection they might have is thinking about subsidies, and particularly corn subsidies have gotten a lot of attention. But actually, that represents a very small portion of the overall funding of the bill.
Later on in the show, we're going to talk about the alternative Farm Bill that has come to the fore in for 2018. But setting that aside for now, can you tell me some reasons that so many actors in the food chain and on both sides of the aisle are unhappy with the state of farming today?
Sure. Well, particularly as it relates to the Farm Bill debates, what I hear again and again about the Farm Bill is it represents a huge opportunity, huge resources allocated, as I said, almost $1 trillion. It's really the only national debate that we have about food and farm policy. And so the stakes are very high for advocates and for stakeholders who want to have their voices heard in that process. And I would say there's a range of critiques of how the Farm Bill supports agriculture today, from some sustainable food and conservation advocates, I've heard that there's not enough resources given towards conservation and towards incentives for sustainable growing, and that too much of an incentive is given towards conventional production, the types that are most covered by subsidies and crop insurance. And other folks who might represent the more conventional food and farm interests might say that the bill shouldn't have all the nutrition programs that it has, that those two things should be separate, and that the bill is too expensive and should be sort of broken up. And that's often the political debate that stymies passage of the bill, which we saw in the last Farm Bill debate, 2014. That was a huge stumbling block. And so this one is scheduled to be renewed in 2018, although what I'm hearing is already it looks like the initial drafts of the bill won't be coming for another year or two.
I've been talking with reporter Leah Douglas, who's been giving me a primer on the Farm Bill. You'll hear from her again later in the show. Coming up, we turn to some of the problems facing U.S. farmers. That's after the break.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman.
And as it stands, everything about our ag system from a government standpoint is aimed toward trying to keep as much corn and soybeans in production as possible.
That's journalist Ted Genoways. He's talking to me about the year he spent with a farming family in Nebraska to document their struggles. He published a book about his experience last year. It's called This Blessed Earth.
I was interested in having a different kind of perspective on farm life in general. I think that there have been a lot of misconceptions that have arisen about small farms in recent years, that very often when we're talking about how to reform the food system and how to support family farms, there are underlying assumptions that really misconstrue what farm life is like now. And rather than this kind of quiet, bucolic existence that is far removed from the worries and troubles of the world, I wanted to find a place that really allowed the reader to see just how much of national and international issues run right through farm country. So while I was on the lookout for this sort of thing, my wife and I, the photographer Marianne Andre, had been working on a series of stories about the Keystone XL pipeline, which is slated to run through eastern Nebraska. And there's a group of farmers and ranchers who have been opposing the pipeline and have been protesting in various ways. One of the families that we had followed and had written a bit about was the Hammond family, who had built a barn, had built a wind-powered and solar-powered barn directly in the path of where the pipeline was sited to pass. And Rick Hammond, the patriarch of that family, said that he had decided to do this because he wanted to show that they could build, you know, with just a single solar array and a small wind turbine, they could build something that would put more power back onto the grid in Nebraska than this oil pipeline ever would.
So let's talk about sort of the nuts and bolts of what it is they do there. They raise both crops and cattle. They've been doing cattle for 40 years. And yet, after going through everything he's gone through, Rick, the patriarch, observes that farmers are the world's biggest optimists. You have to be optimistic in this business just to keep going, or at least have an awful short memory.
So I have a cousin who has farmed for many, many years who always says that farmers are the biggest gamblers that there are. You're gambling on what kind of seed you're going to plant. You take calculated risks in deciding how much herbicide to apply, how much fertilizer to apply. There are calculated risks in deciding how much water to apply for irrigated land. And the whole game is trying to reduce your inputs, as they're called, to reduce the amount of cost that you incur in order to make a profit just through volume on a product that has a very, very narrow margin. And so in a field where your profit may be found in getting a few more bushels than your neighbors get out of a whole field. That is a high-stakes game that is really based on taking calculated risks at all times.
When farmers choose to be in this game, the game of corn and soybeans, these two rotational crops that are such a big part of the landscape in Nebraska and some adjoining states, and yet their income, their gain can literally be down to a handful of bushels. Why is there not a bigger push to types of agriculture that requires less land, less individual inches of watching, and a higher upside of value?
Well, the answer is complicated, but it really boils down to where the incentives are placed. And that has everything to do with everything from how farm subsidies are allotted to how crop insurance is given out, and even how land is taxed. I mean, in Nebraska, for example, there's a big push to tax farmland to what they call its highest use. Well, of course, what that means is that the most profitable product that could be raised on that property. Well, if soybean prices are high, that means that you're going to be taxed on that land as if it's soybean land, whether it's soybeans or sorghum. And so you plant soybeans and you try to capture that profit.
So let's talk about that a little bit. The part of your book in which you discuss Henry Ford and his role in propagating soybeans in the modern farmer's toolkit is just fascinating.
I have to say that was one of the surprises of the research for me too. I started, you know, just trying to figure out when soybeans had come onto the scene, in part because my dad, who grew up on farms in western Nebraska, kept saying, you know, when I was a kid, when he was growing up in the 40s, he said, you know, we didn't see soybeans, and now it is half of the acreage that's being planted in the middle of the country. And how did that happen? So it was a surprise to me to discover that it was really a product of the Dust Bowl in World War II, as we were looking for crops that were drought resistant but also had multi-use that they could be put to. And Henry Ford was the one who recognized that you could take the soybean and mill it, and you got oils from it that could be used for industrial purposes, which is, of course, what he was interested in order to use the oils to make paint for his cars and plastic parts for the cars and so on. But the byproduct, the milled part of the soybean, could still be given as feed to livestock. And so it had a byproduct that still had a profit potential in it.
It's a wonderful book. Thank you so much, Ted.
Thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Ted Genoways is a contributing editor at Mother Jones, The New Republic, and Pacific Standard. His book is called This Blessed Earth, A Year in the Life of an American Family Farm. The financial stressors that farmers face can have far-reaching consequences, including on the environment. Journalist Carson Vaughn is witnessing this firsthand in Omaha, Nebraska.
We're in this weird situation where they can also justify it in reverse and say, well, it's a really crummy year for commodity prices. Corn's not doing well, or soybeans aren't doing well. And because of that, I need to plant every acre I can to soak up what few pennies left I have in this field. And again, the trees are in the way of me reaping those benefits.
The Dust Bowl was a period of severe drought and wind erosion in the Great Plains that caused tens of thousands of families to abandon their farms. To ameliorate the damage, FDR issued an executive order allocating $15 million at that time for the planting of trees to protect the soil. Now, those trees are under threat. This is such a sad story to me.
Yeah.
First of all, can you explain what the trees do? And do you know how FDR knew that these shelter belts, as they're called, should be planted? Because it really was a time in which the wind was just blowing off the topsoil.
Yeah, that's right. Millions of tons of topsoil were blowing all the way out to the eastern seaboard. I mean, when FDR first announced this executive order in July 1939, he had done that following a storm, I think, that occurred in April. But that was hitting the East Coast cities like D.C. and New York especially. People in New York talked about being at the top of the Empire State Building and not being able to even see down into Central Park. There were cruise ships off the coast that talked about the sands blowing off the coast. I mean, they could see it that far away. So that sort of gives you the idea of the scope of what the Dust Bowl looked like at the time.
So how many trees were planted and over what expanse of land?
I think it was 220 million trees over 33,000 Great Plains farms. I think it was 18,000 miles of windbreaks total.
So in essence, the federal government came in and they planted trees on individually owned land.
Yeah, that's right. And it was sort of a joint effort. It was kind of split. The federal government came in, provided the trees, the farmers planted the trees and, you know, put up the supplies to do all that. So it was definitely a joint effort between, you know, private farmers and the federal government.
What else do these shelter belts do besides just physically stopping the eroded soil from blowing farther away?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's a great question because a lot of conservationists now really like shelter belts because they provide more than just the one benefit of preventing wind erosion. They do a bunch of secondary benefits. They trap moisture in the soil in the winter. So when the snow comes, it traps that snow, keeps that moisture in the soil for the next go around. On top of that, it increases the crop yields. There's been decades now worth of studies showing that these shelter belts do increase the crop yields. They also provide natural wildlife habitat for birds and pollinators, which is also a nice check, you know, on insects on those crops. Not that farmers or ranchers use it so much more this way anymore, but they provide a natural wood supply. You know, if they need it, that is on the table. And ranchers especially rely on windbreaks. They provide a nice guard for cattle in the winter. And then, you know, one that we should definitely not forget about, but we often do, is just the simple aesthetics of having this green wall, you know, out here in the Great Plains. I think humans sort of inherently understand the value of seeing a little bit of wildlife around them, and they understand the protection that those trees provide around their own homesteads. So we don't so often see trees being torn out from the homesteads. We see them being torn out from the middle of the fields.
So there's one other thing that all those trees do, right? They sequester huge amounts of carbon.
That's right. I left out one of the biggest ones. And I did that, honestly, because reporting out here, that's almost a non-starter. Talking about climate change out here in terms of the trees doesn't get you very far. But of course, all the scientists and climate change officials look at that as one of the biggest benefits of these windbreaks. Farmers don't necessarily talk about it in that, you know, in those terms, but scientists certainly do, and they do help provide carbon sequestration.
Okay, so we've talked about all the good things about having these trees planted. Why are they being uprooted?
It's sad, but it comes down to the bottom dollar, you know. We live in an economy right now out in the Great Plains where all the incentives come from planting fence row to fence row. So farmers, you know, in a good year, they see like in 2012, say we had $8 corn, $8 bushel corn, and that was great. But farmers looked at all the acres the trees were taking up on their fields, and they thought, if I tear those out and plant more corn or more soybeans, I'm going to see a pretty penny at the end of the day.
Has there ever been an incentive system for shelter belts within the Farm Bill?
Yeah, there are incentives given through the CRP programs and a lot of the local, like in Nebraska, we have Nebraska Resource Districts. There are entities and governmental groups that do provide incentives for planting trees in the same way they provide incentives for planting, you know, prairie grasses and that kind of thing. Unfortunately, that's much more abstract for most of the farmers out here. You know, it's a lot easier to calculate the price of commodities. Farmers know what corn and soybeans are going for. It's a lot harder to calculate the sort of abstract benefits that you get from planting a row of trees. And what we found is that farmers are most receptive to having, you know, that official on the ground saying trees are beneficial. And what we don't see a ton of are people that are trained in agroforestry. We see a lot more officials on the ground with groups like the NRD or the CRP programs who know how to plant corn, know how to plant soybeans, but we don't see that many people advocating for trees. And because of that, farmers aren't advocating for trees.
Maybe someone could work into the next Farm Bill cycle some sort of cash incentive for maintaining shelter belts.
That's right. Most of the trees planted now are done through cost share programs. And, you know, that's great. But most of the farmers I talk to look at that and they say that's just that's not a big enough incentive for me to want to do it. They're still seeing more dollars coming out of more acres put into whatever row crop they're producing.
That's Carson Vaughn. His article on FDR's trees was reported in collaboration with the Weather Channel and the Food and Environment Reporting Network. Find a link to it on the Good Food website.
You know, at times we felt like we were sacrificing ourselves to feed our community.
That's journalist Debbie Weingarten. She's talking about the hardships she faced when she was a small-scale farmer. The suicide rate among America's farmers is more than double that of U.S. veterans. So why don't we hear more about it? Debbie recently reported on the crisis for The Guardian.
I was a co-owner of a vegetable farm here in southern Arizona. Primarily grew vegetables, but also raised dairy goats and layer hens.
What was your experience personally? Did you struggle with depression and anxiety?
I did. My experience was layered and complicated. We had high debt, which is really typical of a farm operation. We struggled with issues like finding and affording labor. We often worked 7 days a week. Everything we made from product sales went back to running the farm, so we really weren't paying ourselves at all.
Is there an idea of why farmers take their lives at such alarming rates?
Well, farmer suicide rate definitely correlates with farm economics. And one thing that I think people don't realize is that we are currently in a farm crisis. The cost of production, which is essentially what it costs a farmer to produce a product, for many crops is higher than what it can be sold for on the market. And that means that farmers are paying out of their own pockets to produce products for the rest of us. That takes food off their tables, that takes money from their kids' college funds. And we know that as we deepen into farm crises, that the rate of farmer suicide goes up.
Is this true across the globe?
Yes. As I mentioned in the Guardian piece, an Australian farmer dies by suicide every 4 days. In the UK, one farmer each week takes his or her own life. In France, one farmer dies by suicide every 2 days. And in India, since 1995, more than 270,000 farmers have died by suicide.
Could you describe the agrarian imperative theory as laid out by psychologist and behavioral health expert Mike Rossman?
Yeah, so Dr. Mike Rossman, who I featured heavily in the Guardian piece, has been studying the behavioral health of farm people for about 40 years. And over the course of that time, he developed what he calls the agrarian imperative theory, which essentially says that farmers have this deep need and this instinctual purpose to produce food, fiber, shelter, and fuel from the land, and that because of this, they have this deep need to hang on to their land and their resources at all costs in order to provide those products. And so this drive, which is the thing that makes farmers so good at farming and so able to overcome stressful situations, the other side of that coin is that it exacerbates failure. For example, if a farmer loses a crop, he or she feels that failure on a really profound level, and that distress can become depression and anxiety and sometimes lead to suicide.
I would also imagine that farmers decide to stay in the land and juggle all different kinds of difficult situations because they like the lifestyle. I hesitate even to use that term, but they like being in a more rural landscape, having children grow up, seeing the process of farming. It's not like a regular business that if it fails, you can just sell what's left and move on to something different that doesn't have any emotional content.
Absolutely. Farming is absolutely a lifestyle. It's not a 9-to-5. And I think that's something that for those of us on the table side of the food system, we're just removed from that reality. You know, we get to clock in and clock out and leave our jobs and we live in a different place where we work. And that's not true for farmers. You know, as we've seen farmers lose their businesses or have to leave for cities, leave the rural landscape, I think that there's this great social crisis that happens among farmers who have to then adjust to a different life.
Do we know how much higher the suicide rate is of farmers than the general population?
So the last data that we have on occupational suicide is from data from 2012. That's the latest data that we have. And when the CDC released their occupational suicide report in 2016, that's the data that they used. And according to that data, people working in agriculture, so that includes farmers, ranchers, lumber harvesters, and fishers, die by suicide at a rate 5 times higher than the general population and 2 times more than military veterans.
Wow, that is startling. How available is therapy for farmers who seek treatment, and is seeking treatment something that farmers do?
Yeah, I think that you nailed it. There are two problems here. One is that it's currently very difficult to find behavioral health care for farmers. One of the important factors in providing behavioral health care for farmers is that it has to be culturally competent, which means that the therapist needs to be trained in the language of agriculture, needs to understand the stressors and the economic pressures that farmers are facing. I wrote in the article that, you know, if a farmer goes to a therapist and the therapist says, well, just go take a vacation, you know, take the weekend off and go away, the farmer, you know, will say, well, my cows aren't on a 5-day-a-week schedule, you know, so I can't do that. The second thing is that there are cultural barriers that are preventing farmers from seeking therapy. Though I would say that from what I hear, especially from Dr. Roseman, that is beginning to change. But farmers are less willing in general to seek help.
Are there any studies which show an effect on the number of suicides when there is appropriate help available?
I don't know of studies, but the qualitative information that I've gathered from people who have been involved in providing support to farmers is that, you know, during the 1980s farm crisis, which is the economic crisis that most of us are familiar with that happened across farms and rural America in the 1980s, many agricultural states developed helplines for farmers. And most of those states that developed the hotlines saw a reduction in the number of farmer suicides.
Are there still those helplines available?
Most of the states that developed the helplines during the 1980s farm crisis have shuttered them. So there are only a handful of helplines that are specifically directed towards farm people.
Given that we have the Farm Bill coming up and people are already starting to talk about a very robust alternative vision for the Farm Bill, are there any initiatives that some people would like to see reside in the Farm Bill that respond to this issue?
Absolutely. There was a program that was approved in the 2008 U.S. Farm Bill. It was called the Farm and Ranch Stress Assistance Network, and it would have provided regional and national helplines, counseling for farmers at an estimated cost of about $18 million annually. And while it was approved, funding was never appropriated to it.
Thank you so much, Debbie.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Debbie Weingarten is a writer based in Tucson, Arizona, and the editor of Baja Arizona Magazine. Find a link to her Guardian article on the Good Food website. The National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 1-800-273-8255. After the break, we turn from problems to solutions. We're talking about proposals for fixing America's farming system. Not a big job. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Evan Kleinman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Many say America's farming system is broken, so we now turn our attention to the people who are working on a solution. For that, I'm back with Leah Douglas. Hello again.
Hi again.
This year, a new $1 trillion farm bill is up for debate in Congress, and there's a growing chorus of voices calling for radical changes. Leading the charge seems to be Earl Blumenauer, the Democratic U.S. representative from Oregon's 3rd District. Leah, you recently wrote an article for Civil Eats about Representative Blumenauer's radical proposal to revise the farm bill. What's so radical about it, and what problems does it hope to solve?
Sure. Well, Representative Blumenauer is an interesting voice to come out leading the charge for farm bill reform. And one of the reasons why his stance is new and unusual is he represents a majority urban district. Much of his district is in Portland, Oregon. And that's unusual for folks who, for representatives and members of Congress who are highly invested in agriculture and food and farm policy. They often come from what we would think of as the most traditional food and farming states in the Midwest, California, et cetera. And so Representative Blumenauer is in an interesting position where he brings a much more environmental and health-focused lens towards the farm bill. And he is taking the approach of, I want to bring, you know, the farm bill out of the shadows, as he puts it, and into give it a broader frame so that more Americans and more members of Congress can feel that they have a stake in passing a bill that meets the criteria that he's laid out. And so his bill provides a lot more incentives and regulations around sustainability, around strong environmental protections, around conservation efforts, greater research investment in organics and other types of sustainable agriculture than the bill that we had in 2014.
So many people, Michael Pollan, I think amongst the most vocal among them, are saying that until it's called the food bill rather than just the farm bill, that it won't have a chance to gain traction amongst eaters all across the country.
Right, and I've definitely heard that as well. And I think from both Michael Pollan and from Representative Blumenauer, when I was interviewing them for the story that I wrote, they both emphasized that reframing it as a piece of environmental legislation, a piece of public health legislation, was a one way to try to connect with more consumers, with more Americans, because especially given the increased difficulty of passing any legislation in Congress, the Farm Bill is one that could be a vehicle for the types of environmental regulations that would be difficult to pass on their own.
Advocates for the alternative bill say that federal subsidies aren't going to the right people. They're calling for spending less on feed and fuel farms and more on food-producing farms. Can you expand on that?
Today, we see that about the top 1% of farmers receive about 27% of subsidies that are allocated through the Farm Bill. And what that means is most of those farmers are primarily commodity growers, and they disproportionately collect, sometimes hundreds of thousands of dollars in federal subsidies to promote the growth of the specific crops that they are investing in. And so in his Food and Farm Act, the alternative bill, Representative Blumenauer proposes capping some of these subsidy programs, including crop insurance premiums, so that the existing funding can be more evenly distributed and that some of that funding can be distributed towards sustainable growing and towards incentivizing what are called specialty crops in the Farm Bill, which is mostly fruits and vegetables, aka not commodities, rather than all of that money or the majority of it going towards a small number of commodity producers with enormous acreage and enormous production levels.
Is he talking about any links between higher taxation for those who leave behind eco problems like giant pools of manure, for example, and lowering tax rate or giving other incentives to those who farm in a more eco-sustainably way?
Well, he does discuss having greater water protection, better pest management, and better conservation efforts on the whole, including how to manage waste and other types of outputs from farms. I'm not clear on exactly the tax ramifications of that, but within the framework of subsidization and crop insurance, he does discuss in the bill how to better incentivize and promote stronger conservation behaviors on behalf of all producers, including the sort of biggest and most pollutive ones.
This alternative bill has a clause that would require factory farms to submit their annual greenhouse gas emissions, for example. Tell us about that.
Sure. Well, factory farms are huge producers of greenhouse gases, particularly methane, that are responsible for a lot of the detrimental effects of climate change that we're facing. And communities surrounding factory farms are very heavily impacted by the poor air quality that is often a result of a high concentration of factory farms in an area. So having a metric by which the factory farms have to report exactly how they're affecting the atmosphere around them could give advocates and communities another tool to call for better regulation. And we've seen over the past few years, particularly at the state level, that regulation of industrial farming has been degraded as big ag advocacy and trade organizations have really pushed and lobbied at the states and in the federal government to have less reporting, less regulation, and communities are really suffering from that. So in this farm bill, it's one way to use this sort of federal, national scope piece of legislation to give communities another tool to push back on industrial farming in their areas.
The proposed alternative bill also pays special attention to animal welfare, something that's been left out of past farm bills. Why now?
That's a great question. And actually, it's really timely to be talking about animal welfare this week because the Department of Agriculture just rolled back some proposed animal welfare regulations for the organic industry that had taken years of advocacy to get promoted to the level of USDA attention and rulemaking, and had reached a pretty broad consensus in the organic sector that better animal welfare requirements were important. And so I think it's another opportunity, as Representative Blumenauer pointed out to me, to sort of use this large piece of legislation to get through some regulations that in the agencies aren't getting passed.
So have the groups that are throwing their support behind these reforms started to reveal themselves as a kind of unusual coalition? Or are people lining up the way one would imagine they would?
Well, I think increasingly in the past few years, we've seen food and farm issues drawing a wider group of constituency organizations than even in the past, you know, maybe in the last farm bill cycle. Some of the groups supporting this particular piece of legislation were the Humane Society of the United States, Union of Concerned Scientists, the Environmental Working Group, some farmer organizations. And what that shows is that some of those groups that may have not agreed in the past, for instance, animal welfare groups and farmer-oriented groups or environmental groups and farmer-oriented groups may have come into tension around certain regulations, we're increasingly seeing those groups putting aside some of those past differences or figuring out compromises that work for all in the interest of passing national reforms that are deemed sort of the most important. And I would say in my reporting and the local and state level, that's increasingly true as well. As local as in one community that's fighting a factory farm, there's been a few wins in a different agricultural states where communities have pushed back on encroaching factory farming, where the coalition surprised even the residents of the town. They never thought that the immigrant rights community and the environmental community and the animal welfare community could all fight side by side. And so I think what we're seeing at the national level is representative of what's happening in the local scale as well.
Given the new political landscape, we've just watched this massive tax reform bill pass basically with just one side of the aisle. What kind of openness do you think there is to this alternative bill?
Well, I think it will be challenging to imagine passing the bill as it is, as a true alternative to the farm bill. But I think there's some opportunity and some promise in breaking up the bill into individual amendments and bringing them as part of the farm bill debate on the Senate floor and on the House floor, which is often a more agile way to work in some of these reforms into the existing legislation. So I think building support and momentum and campaigns around pushing some of the individual pillars of this legislation that we've discussed could result in an opportunity for individual representatives and senators to bring in broken up pieces of the bill as amendments to the existing legislation.
Well, thank you so much for coming here and at least giving us a tutorial so that we can be informed and therefore talk to our representatives.
Sure. Thank you so much for having me.
That's food policy journalist Leah Douglas telling us about plans to reframe the federal farm bill that's set to make its way through Congress in 2018. You can find her Civil Eats article about the alternative farm bill on the Good Food blog. Visit blogs.kcrw.com/goodfood.
The thing that bothers me most about this whole disagreement, this whole the food movement versus sort of conventional agriculture, is the extent to which it has gotten polarized.
That's food and science journalist Tamar Haspel. She recently wrote an article for the Washington Post arguing against the idea that small local organic farms are the key to fixing our food system. I think a lot of people, many of whom are listeners of this show, want there to be an ideal world in which everything can be handled by small local farms.
Yeah, I think that that's right. And I think that in some ways it makes sense because where there's an interface between actual people who eat and people who farm, it is at the farmer's market. It is the small local person. It is where people feel comfortable, where they can get a handle on, you know, our food system. The people who are growing, you know, corn and wheat and soy in the Midwest are far, far away. And it's easy to demonize those people or even just get the sense that they're not acting in eaters' best interest, that they're, you know, corporate tools or they're in it for the profit or something like that. And but if you go out to the farms where those people are actually growing those crops, I think a lot of the people would have a different idea about them. One of the big things that's acting against sort of a big and nuanced view of the food system is just that most consumers have a very small slice of it in their backyard.
So you enumerated four reasons that there are these tremendous economic, logistical, topographical, and even arithmetic reasons.
Right.
That these kind of farms that we're all familiar with can only be a small slice of this reimagined responsible food system?
Well, the biggest one, and it covers, you know, both arithmetic and probably one of the others, is what they grow. Small farms grow what the USDA calls specialty crops, and which the rest of us know as fruits and vegetables. And fruits and vegetables is sort of where everybody hangs their hat, both when they talk about, you know, a healthful diet and a healthy food system. And again, you can see why. They're some of the most nutrient-dense foods in our diets. But I think people have a misconception about it because only 1% of our cropland grows vegetables right now. And if we were all to eat all the fruits and vegetables we're supposed to eat, we could grow them all on something like 10% of our cropland. There's no reasonable scenario where more than 10% of cropland would grow fruits and vegetables. And the reason that those are the only crops that these kinds of farms can grow is that these are the crops that they can make money growing. And, you know, they have all my sympathy here. I'm an oyster farmer. I am in favor of luxury products for rich people. But growing vegetables and fruits on a small scale is the way for small farms to make ends meet because these are high margin, high value, read expensive crops.
And yet some people in some states, like my state, California, would say to you, but at our farmers markets, we have something called the market match, and all the markets take EBT cards. So actually, there is access to a much larger part of the population for fruits and vegetables than one might imagine.
I think that's absolutely true. And I applaud the programs that are going out and making sure that some of these underserved communities do have access to fruits and vegetables. But if you look at the difference in price between, say, broccoli and, say, lentils, this is where you'll see that the difference in cost is an order of magnitude. It's not a small difference. It's not something that subsidies can make go away. A serving of lentils costs a farmer about a half a cent to grow. A serving of broccoli costs a farmer about 14 cents to grow. That's a 28 times. And I guess if there's one thing I would like to convey to people who are trying to make smart decisions about eating and about our food system, is that there's this huge world of difference between fruits and vegetables and grains and legumes. So corn and soy get this terrible rap because, of course, they're part and parcel of an industrialized food system that has some terrible consequences, including, you know, fueling a system of processed foods that are heavy in calories and not heavy in nutrients that have contributed to obesity and disease. But if you think about it in a different way, if you think about these crops, the grains and legumes that carpet the Midwest, as staple crops rather than commodity crops, you know, it's rice, it's corn, it's wheat. These are the nutritious foods that have been the backbone of the human diet since civilization began. And the reason for that is that you can grow a lot of food on a little land. It's cheap and it's storable.
And you can do it at tremendous scale using very high technology right now.
Absolutely. I got to ride in a combine in Iowa not that long ago, and it is a marvel.
But what do you say to people who say, well, that's all well and good, but even if we take into consideration the amount of wheat and the amount of lentils that humans are eating in the United States, most of that soy and corn is going to animals that are being fed in a system that most of us believe needs some change.
I say, hallelujah, you're absolutely right, and that has to change. And I guess the gist of the argument that I was making was that what we think of as the food movement, and that's, you know, where we started this conversation, what we think about as the food movement is absolutely right about the problems in our system. And you just mentioned a very important one, that we're growing these grains and we are not eating them as nutritious foods. We're eating them as processed foods, as meat, and we're putting them in our cars. And that's a huge problem. But where the food movement goes wrong is that the answer to the problems with an industrialized system is not a non-industrialized system where everybody's growing broccoli around cities. It's a better industrialized system.
What do you think a broader image of a responsible food system would look like?
Oh, a broader image of a responsible food system has humans eating more of the grains and legumes that are staple crops. I want to see us eat more lentils and more chickpeas and more barley and more oats and less meat, and meat that has been raised differently. And that's a whole new conversation. And I think that that is the way that we can leverage the cropland we have on this planet to feed people both nutritiously and responsibly. And of course, fruits and vegetables are a part of that, but they are necessarily a small part. If we tried to make fruits and vegetables the dominant source of food for people, we wouldn't have enough planet to feed them, because those crops take a lot more land to grow.
In talking to the farmers that you speak to in the Midwest, who are involved in a more conventional part of the system, are they aware that certain things need to change?
They are very aware that certain things need to change. And they're aware, I think, for two reasons. One is that many of the farmers I talk to are very committed to being the best stewards of their land that they can be. But some of it is simply that it's in their interest. You know, when the 50s to the 80s, there was such a focus on growing more, 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 and there wasn't a focus on maintaining soil health. There are a lot of things that we understand about these systems that just wasn't understood then. And now a lot of farmers are playing catch up. But I can tell you that, you know, the men and women who are farming thousands of acres in Iowa and Minnesota and Kansas want to be able to leave their farm for their kids better than how they found it. But they're also aware that with climate change, they have to have more arrows in their quiver. They have to have more tools. They have to have a more resilient way to grow food. So there are pressures on these farmers from all sides. And believe me, they understand it better than you or me, you know, or anybody else who's sitting on the coasts, you know, with our feet up talking about how to grow a better food system. The thing that bothers me most about this whole disagreement, this whole the food movement versus sort of conventional agriculture, is the extent to which it has gotten polarized. And I guess the question I'm always asking myself is, how did people who actually have common ground to stand on, because everybody I know in this wants to do better with food, wants to grow it better, wants to feed people better, how did it get so out of control? Nasty.
Do you think that that more measured discourse is going to happen in the context of the 2018 Farm Bill?
Well, Evan, I'm trying real hard, and it doesn't feel like I'm making a lot of headway. So it's very hard to be optimistic about this. And you're absolutely right that the Farm Bill can be one of the most contentious and polarizing pieces of legislation. But an interesting thing is happening out there. We're seeing, we being, you know, policy people who watch this space, we're seeing that there are some strange bedfellows from the far left and the far right, think the Heritage Foundation and the Environmental Working Group, working together because both of those groups want to change the subsidy system. And I think that there is a lot of pressure from a lot of different constituencies to try and change the Farm Bill to pay more attention to environmental impact. And there are a lot of conversations happening about just how to do that. So, you know, I'm an optimist by nature, and so I am hoping that that will be fruitful and perhaps yield not just a better Farm Bill, but maybe even some kumbaya.
That's Tamar Haspel on how local organic farms will not save America's food system. Find a link to her article on the Good Food website. Her monthly column for the Washington Post is called Unearthed. Coming up, we close with a visit to the farmers market to find out what our local farmers have to say about farm policy.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman. We close out our show about farming on a fitting note. You guessed it. We're going to the Santa Monica Farmers Market. Farmers Market correspondent Laura Avery is here to talk about a criminally underrated ingredient.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We're celebrating late winter, transitioning to early spring here at the Farmers Market. And as always, we love to catch up with a local chef to find out what they're buying from the market. So happy to meet Trevor Ferris, who is the executive chef at Brennan's. Yeah, the Brennan's, that's the turtle racing place on Lincoln in Marina Del Rey. And Trevor, you're here and you're shopping for ingredients. And tell us what you're going to be cooking up at Brennan's.
Yeah, well, we're looking for fennel today. Fennel's great because you can use like every part of the plant, right? You can use the bulb, the stalks, the fronds as garnish. You can use the pollen, the seeds, like literally everything. It's one of those magic plants. So it has that great anise-y flavor, black licorice. That's really, you know, vibrant and vegetal when you eat it raw, but the flavor gets really mellowed and sweet when you cook it long too. So there's a lot of different applications for it.
Yeah, and fennel bulbs, they're kind of weird because when you get them, it's almost like a celery stalk. You pull all the fronds off and then you get these curved little things at the bottom. So it's not really a bulb you can really deal with like a bulb. Well, I mean, how do you break down a fennel?
Well, you cut the stalks off and you cut the root end off, and then you can kind of treat it like an onion, just a little trickier to deal with onion, but you just core the middle of it and you can dice it up the same way that you would another vegetable.
And how much of the stem are you leaving on there?
The green stalk, we take that off and use it in stocks. We like to use everything, but it's not really, it's pretty tough and fibrous, so you don't want to eat that raw.
Okay, so what you're going to be making with it, particularly what you have in mind today, would be what?
Oh, so we do a steamed clams dish that uses fennel all over the place. So the base for the dish is a stock that we make that's really fennel reinforced. It's got fennel bulb in there, but it also has fennel seed. It's got some orange juice and orange zest because that goes really well with fennel, kind of plays off the flavors nicely. So that stock goes into the dish, and then we also have raw fennel that we dice up and saute in the dish. We also hit it with a dash of Pernod, which is kind of an anise-flavored liqueur, and we garnish with fennel fronds. So the whole thing is like very, very fennel-y, yeah.
And the clams are cooked in the fennel stock?
Yeah, they are. White wine and fennel stock and a little splash of Pernod.
And then for the fennel pollen, is that something that you buy or would you get it from the flower and then shake it yourself?
So I imagine it's a pretty difficult thing to process. So we would buy fennel pollen and then just use it sparingly as a garnish. It's really potent stuff and it has a beautiful flavor, but we're not processing that ourselves. Yeah.
It's one of those kind of newer ingredients you just start hearing about, and then you start looking for it, and then you find out that it's been there for a while. So that's what's so exciting about being here, is all these new discoveries.
Yeah. It is a pretty hip ingredient right now, though, fennel pollen.
Okay, well, this sounds great. And it's so good to hear that Brennan's is sort of being revitalized, rethought.
Yeah, we're trying to build on the reputation that they made, where it was a kind of staple in the neighborhood for a lot of years, 40 years, I think. And we just got the opportunity to take it over. We still have some nods to the old Brennan's, but we wanted to freshen it up and make it brighter and put our spin on it, so.
Party on. Okay, well, thank you so much.
Okay, thank you so much, Laura.
That was Chef Trevor Ferris, executive chef at Brennan's on Lincoln, the one with the turtles. And he's here at the market finding wonderful things to make at the restaurant and telling us a little bit more about fennel. I'm visiting now with Chris Edwards, who works with Rutiz Farm. Rutiz Farm is located in Arroyo Grande on the Central Coast. Chris, you've got this fennel on your table now. And as we're speaking, it seems like you grow fennel on the farm all year round. So can you explain to us what the planting schedule is for it and why fennel?
Well, fennel's a popular item. The restaurants can't get enough of it. Our customers can't get enough of it. It definitely is such a wonderful little treat. For growing, we don't direct seed. What we do is we have a nursery that we actually give them our seeds and they start the process for us. It usually stays at their nursery for maybe like a couple months. And then after that, we get the transplants and we plug those into the ground and finish off the process.
Does it keep growing in the same place, or when it's done, you move on to another bed and replant?
Yeah, so with our farm, to keep the soil healthy, what we end up doing is crop rotation. So we never plant the same thing in the same spot. You know, we usually try to wait at least a year before we do that.
So how do you get it out of the ground? You pull it up by the roots?
So what we'll do is we'll hold the stalk and then we'll come underneath the soil and cut the roots with a knife. And then essentially you'll just like clean up the roots off of it really quickly. And sometimes you pull the outer fronds off of it. And what that'll do is it'll take just two small pieces of the bulb off and then it just cleans it up really well.
Okay, and then at this point, how long are the fronds?
I mean, it varies again on the time of year, but the fronds are probably like a foot and a half tall, roughly.
Okay, and that all stays with the fennel when you bring it in?
That all stays with the fennel. We definitely encourage people to take their fennel tops because you can utilize them. It's really great for making pestos or soup stock. You can cut it up and throw it into salads for, you know, just like a hint flavor of that anise. So yeah, I mean, some customers definitely have us cut it for them and some of the restaurants do, but most people take them.
So you pretty much grow fennel all year round.
Yes, that is correct. We do have an appropriate climate to be able to grow that year round. It's definitely one of a blessing and a curse for the Central Coast. You know, you're able to provide this product year round, but at the same time, you're definitely busting your butt year round.
All right, Chris, well, thank you so much. I love walking by and just getting a whiff of that wonderful anise smell. It's really delightful.
Great, yeah, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. That was Chris Edwards. He is one of the people that comes down every week with Rutiz Farms, and we learned a little more about fennel today, and you can enjoy it cooked or raw. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Thanks for listening to our farming show. It first aired in January. If you missed any part of today's show, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Or download our show wherever you get your podcasts, like Stitcher or Apple Podcasts. Thanks to the Good Food team. I'm Evan Kleiman. I'll be back next week with more Good Food.